Hello, and welcome to the So You Want to Be a Marine Biologist podcast, where we learn about the ocean, share sea stories, and explore ocean careers. I'm your host, Kara Muzia. Let's dive into today's episode. Have you ever wanted to explore the underwater realm, but aren't sure how to get dive certified? I've got you covered. Head over to marinebio.life/scubaforbeginners and grab your copy of my new scuba guide. In it, I cover the different certifying agencies, gear, lingo, and the number one thing to look out for when you're getting certified. This guide will leave you confident in how to become certified and ready to dive in. Head on over to marinebio.life/scubaforbeginners to get your copy and get diving already. marinebio.life/scubaforbeginners. Hello, mermaids, pirates, ocean lovers, and land lovers. Welcome to today's show. Question: what does the Loch Ness Monster eat for breakfast? Scotch eggs. When going to the bathroom in the woods, did you know you're going to use the facilities? My guest today is Callum McLean. He is a filmmaker, broadcaster, photographer, and outdoor swimmer. He's the host on BBC Social and has his own wildly popular YouTube, Instagram, and now TikTok channels. His new book, 1001 Outdoor Swimming Tips, is written to get people out and excited about being submerged in nature. Today's episode is such a fun one. We get to chat about all things swimming outside in both the ocean and freshwater bodies. Callum shares insights into what it's like outdoor swimming and why you should get started today. He also shares some of the best adventure stories, including his field story at the end. So stay tuned for that. Please enjoy. Callum, welcome to the So You Want to Be a Marine Biologist podcast. I am so excited to chat with you today.
Thanks a lot, Cara. Yeah, it's great to be on the show.
So you have done some incredible things, some incredible swims. What inspired you to take that first plunge into the open, wild, outdoor swimming waters?
It's hard to like put a finger on exactly what it was, but I often think back to like a particular swim, and there's one swim that really sticks out in my mind, and it was about almost 13 years ago now. And I'm Scottish, you might hear through my accent, but I was born in Australia, in Tasmania, and I've been back quite a few times. And I was back in Tasmania and I was standing looking at this big river called the Derwent, and I was just standing looking at the river and I thought, could I swim to the other side? And I was like, wow, I've never actually done anything quite like that before. And it was just a question came into my head, like, why couldn't I? Yeah, surely I could just go and do it. So I borrowed a wetsuit from my uncle and left early next morning, like in the pitch blacks, started swimming across this road. It's not too far. It's just over a kilometer. I just remember the excitement of setting myself the challenge. And I swam across the river. In hindsight, there's a lot of things, you know, it's like foolishness of having an idea but not really thinking of some of the safety things. So I would have taken a lot of other safety things into account. But anyway, I managed the swim and I was running back over the bridge barefoot in my wetsuit. People were cycling to work past me and there was no triathlon or anything on. So people must be thinking, what is this guy doing? It was like 6:30 in the morning. The light's just getting brighter in the sky. But I just really remember the excitement of it and the buzz of setting a challenge. Pretty straightforward, pretty simple. And obviously I could swim. I was a decent swimmer, so I knew I was capable of it. But setting the challenge and then just going and working out how to do it and doing it, really, that kind of stuck with me. And then from then on, I've, you know, always looked for interesting places to swim. And it's often the location that inspires me when it comes to swimming. You know, I get bored of just maybe going to the same place and swimming laps. I don't really swim indoors that often because I get bored of it. So it's often about location, what's around you, you know, the landscape you're in, the things you can see below the water. It's really, it kind of inspires me to go new places and see new things. But it was that one swim that does stick in the mind as something that really, yeah, gave me the bug for it.
Yeah. So I'm curious, what were some of the safety things that you're like, hindsight, it was a good thing I lucked out?
Yeah, so I did find out afterwards that some people do jump from that bridge. There's a big bridge above where I swam, and some people do jump from it. And if I had been spotted in the water, you know, there's a chance they would have thought I was attempting suicide or something. So they might have sent the police and then the Coast Guard and all these boats might have turned up. So that was one thing I didn't quite take into account. I think where the river is there, so there's a river flow, but it is also tidal, the river. The tide quite reaches that point. The fact I didn't know means obviously I didn't really look into it. So I wasn't totally sure of the current, for example. I did have a look at it in the daylight and I cycled over the bridge and had a look and I considered whether I could do it. But it was things like that. You know, I swam in darkness and I was wearing a wetsuit, so I was really not very visible to anyone. So no one's probably going to see me in the water. On one hand, that's going to get me across and not get me spotted. But on the other hand, it's not the safest thing to do either. You know, there could be boats or something coming. I have heard that it could be, you know, some sharks in the water there, but it's not very likely in that part of Tasmania. It's not too sharky, as they say. My uncle's a surfer and we went to some beaches, went surfing, and he's like, yeah, we sometimes surf here, it's a little bit sharky. So I quite like that description of a beach, but those are some of the things I didn't maybe consider when I started out. So I'm always trying to encourage people, especially who are getting into swimming for the first time, to think about these things and make your swim exciting but keep it safe too.
So you mentioned, you know, its location, which I can totally understand. I swam competitively in high school, and that black line on the bottom of the pool gets real, real fast. So I love that, the idea of going outdoors and swimming and like seeing something new and actually swimming to a place rather than just back and forth, back and forth. What do you see in the water, though? For some reason, I don't picture the water being that clear. Can you really see a lot?
It totally depends on where you are. So speaking generally in Scotland, not going to see that much very often in fresh water, because a lot of our fresh water is very peaty. The kind of soil we've got here is very brown soil, and lots of our lochs, or lakes you'd say, lots of the lochs are very peaty, and also a lot of them very deep, so you don't really see that much after a certain point. If you swim around the coast, there's lots of amazing bits to see around our coasts. So you've got all sorts of kelp beds. You've got bits that are really good for snorkeling. So when you're swimming, I mean, it's not quite the same thing as snorkeling, but often it can be very similar kind of things. If you're swimming around the coast, there's bits we can see all sorts of fish and crabs and urchins and all sorts of things like that. As you go out deeper, you don't see that much. And generally in Scotland, I've not seen that many fish, which is quite interesting, because I swam a few times in Australia, and Australia is so much better for just swimming off the shore. Even in Sydney, you know, in a big city, you can swim in some of the nice bays and you see hundreds of fish. You see also like maybe 10 different kinds of fish. In Scotland, it's much harder work. I think if you want to see wildlife in Scotland, diving is the way to do it, really, because it's kind of abundant wildlife then. But swimming, yeah, not so much. Maybe there's a few places I really like to swim in mountain environments, because I really like being up mountains anyway. So there's a few lochs up in the hills and river pools that are crystal clear. You know, there's nothing, there's not much growing in them, but they are incredibly clear. So you get the daylight playing through the water on a sunny day, which is absolutely beautiful. But you're not going to see that much in terms of actual life in some of those places. You do get these incredible grasses that grow up in some of the mountain lochs, and when the sun hits them, the tips of them can look really red in summer, so that's quite beautiful too. It depends totally on the location. For example, where I swim most regularly, there's lots of stones, but maybe not a whole lot else.
That's fun. So you mentioned diving and seeing more. Do you dive as well?
I have done a bit of diving. When I was back in Australia one time, I spent, it was 5 days on the Great Barrier Reef doing my open water course there. I've dived in Iceland as well, which was an amazing experience. Quite a commercial trip. As long as you've got your ticket, you can go along and you dive between the plates, between the tectonic plates. So you're diving effectively between America and Europe, and the water is the clearest water I've seen in my life. Absolutely stunning. So that was a really special experience. But actually, I've never dived in Scotland. I've never got around to it. But so I've done a little bit, but I couldn't really call myself a proper diver.
Well, okay. Yeah. you have dove. You are a diver.
Okay, there you go. I'll do that. Yeah, that's good.
You have your certification. That's cool. Wow, getting certified in the Great Barrier Reef. It's hard to beat that. And then then you dive between two continents. So that's some pretty incredible experiences you've had.
Yeah, maybe I don't want to dive anywhere else, because I've experienced maybe the really most some of the most amazing stuff you can possibly. Yes. So I wouldn't want to go somewhere and then get disappointed by it. But yeah, I really enjoy it, especially being out in the Great Barrier Reef. You know, you're diving and seeing the coral. And I remember one of the other guys on the course, he got attacked, but a parrotfish, I think, had a go at him, and it left him bleeding, you know, out of his forehead.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So even stuff like that, you know, it was, although it's a beautiful place and you're enjoying this kind of calm experience, there's all, you've got to be like, got to keep your wits about you too, wherever you are.
Oh, always. Always in the ocean, especially with wild animals around. You never know who's going to get territorial.
Like, I've never had that in Scotland. I mean, seals. We get loads and loads of seals here in Scotland, and they will follow you when you swim, but I've never had a bad experience with them, luckily.
Yeah. Have you had many interactions with them other than just following you?
Mainly just following me. Yeah, they get very curious and they'll follow you in a big group, but they keep their distance maybe 20 feet or so, and snort and kind of have a look at you and blow water and stuff. But I've never seen them come quite up to me. If you kayak, you can often see them kayak swimming under your boat when you kayak, which I do quite a bit of kayaking too. Yeah. And I've seen you know, hundreds of them on a beach when I've come round a corner on some of the islands we've got in Scotland out in the west coast. But when I'm swimming, they usually keep their distance from me. Maybe I'm just too messy a swimmer. You know, they're definitely not believing I'm a seal, that's for sure.
I'm trying to figure out what you are. Like, yeah. I don't want to get too close. I'm not sure what it is. Yeah. That's funny. I would thought they'd maybe been curious about your pack. Do you carry your pack behind you when you swim with the seals too?
Yeah, so I'm just thinking some of the occasions where they have followed me, I haven't been always carrying a big tow float or bag or something really bright. So yeah, they've never actually come up and had a nibble of it or anything like that. So yeah, I mean, I was very lucky as well in New Zealand to go and swim in the ocean where they have dolphins nearby, and the dolphins, you know, they put you in the sea and the dolphins can come up to you and they swim very close to you and things like that. In a natural setting, you're not in an aquarium or anything. Yeah, I've had that, but never in Scotland. I've got lots of dolphins here as well and bigger sea life. But the biggest thing I've had close to me in the water would have to be seals.
Very cool. Did you swim growing up at all, like competitively, or was it just like you enjoyed swimming for fun?
Never competitively. No, not at all. Just for fun. We're a very outdoorsy family growing up. So any family holiday, we'd be hill walking or, you know, doing things that involved being outside. So I was often swimming, whether it was in a pool, whether it was in a river, a lake, anything like that. Wherever we were, I'd be trying to go for a swim somewhere, but never at a competitive level. I have done some, as an adult, I've done a little bit of racing in terms of triathlon and swim run events, and then also some winter swimming events, which is, the field is much smaller than, you know, your kind of regular standard swimming events. But yeah, I think I didn't grow up, you know, being a competitive swimmer at all. And in a way, I'm not interested so much in the competition against other people. As I get older, I'm less interested in that and more in the experience of swimming, which is what I really enjoy.
So what's the furthest you've swum?
I think a day over the whole day, around about 29 kilometers. I don't know what that is in miles. It'd be about
15-ish.
So a mile is 1.6 kilometers.
Okay, that's a lot of miles.
That was broken up over a day. So I did a trip a few years ago where I attempted to swim. So my idea was, could you swim from coast to coast across Scotland? There is a way to do it technically, but you have to swim through our canal system here, which is currently illegal to do. So I've not managed it yet. Although it's on my list of things to do, you know, I think if anyone can get permission, surely I've got a chance. So yes, that's a future one. But I found a route further north, which involved walking. So I'd swim, you know, lakes or swim some lochs, swim some rivers, and have to walk sections in between where you'd like portage a canoe, for example. And on the last day, I swam down a river. It was around about 20 kilometers in the river, and to reach it, I had to swim a couple of lochs beforehand. So added it all up. Although some of it was current assisted in the river, to be fair. But I was swimming and having to eat snacks off my bag. You know, there's no support crew, no boat or anything like that looking after me. So I'm having to do everything for myself. So I think that would be the longest I've done in a day. Yeah.
That's a lot to unpack there. That's a lot. Were you by yourself?
Yeah. Yes, I was. So had looked at the route. It's somewhat a popular canoe route. So it starts on the west coast of Scotland at a small village called Pooleau and finishes up, well, you can finish up various places, but it's the River Conin on the east coast of Scotland. So it's not the open ocean, but it's where the sea comes right up a river anyway. I'd wanted to reach seaweed before I stopped. That's my plan. Okay. So I'd looked at the route and decided some bits were swimmable, and I gave myself 6 days because I wanted to swim the river on a Sunday when there would be no one fishing on the river. There's no salmon fishing in Scotland on a Sunday. Yeah, my plan was always to reach the river to start on the Sunday. Yeah, so I went literally with a big 65-litre dry bag, a big watershed dry bag, which people use mainly for rafting. But you can wear it as a rucksack, so you can walk with it. And then when you swim, basically you tow it behind yourself on a line. I met a few people along the way, and I was wearing fins as well to help with the weight of the bag. The thing is, on the first day, the bag's very heavy because it's full of food. And by day 3 and 4, you're running out of foods, but your bag's a lot lighter. So you're starting to swim faster by then. So that was a really good experience. And I've done a few swim packing or swim hiking or whatever you'd want to call it. I don't quite have a title for it. But these trips that combine journeys of walking and then swimming and then walking again. And it can take you to some amazing places and linking up bodies of water by swimming.
You know, you're the first person that introduced me to that concept. Like the idea of you go for a hike and you swim as part of your hike, right? I like that a lot, but I feel like that's a lot of extra equipment to bring along too. Like it's always a Tetris puzzle to try to figure out exactly how much room you have and what equipment you can bring and fitting that all in the bag. And then now you have like your wetsuit and all that fun stuff on top of it.
Yeah. So it takes a while to get used to and work. So for example, if you're trying like a 5-day trip, it's really quite awkward because I eat a lot as well. So I'm trying to carry enough food for 5 days. Most of these places I go on, you know, you're not going to go past a cafe. You're not going to go and see a restaurant. You're not going to see many people on your journey. So there's not much of a chance to restock. I think if you're doing like kind of day trips, it's not too bad because all you need really is your swimming stuff. And then some way of getting yourself across the water and keeping everything else dry. So often a big dry bag will do it, you know, a big basic one that you can roll up and clip closed and then just tow it behind you. So I think I'm really keen on, you know, people trying these things, but not overcomplicating them, because you really don't need to go out and spend loads of money on gear in the first place. It really helps having good gear, you know, down the line if it's something you enjoy doing. But if you can find yourself, you know, take a walk to a lake and aim for somewhere on the other side. Ideally, that links up in a journey. You know, you're not just getting there and you're stuck on the other side. Working out how to get yourself across, seeing how it was for you, seeing what you kind of need to tweak, seeing what worked, seeing what didn't work, seeing maybe you don't need a wetsuit, depending how warm it is. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. It totally depends on location and time of year, here in Scotland at least. Yeah, and seeing what works for you. And from there, work out if you enjoy actually doing it, and then, you know, yeah, buying more stuff, working a better system each time.
So something that you mentioned very briefly that I find really interesting, nobody fishes for salmon on Sundays. What is the reasoning behind that?
It's the law. Yeah, I don't know the exact details of it, but it's illegal to fish for salmon in Scotland on the rivers on a Sunday. And the salmon fishing season, I don't know, I'm not a salmon fisherman myself. So it's a period of months, I think, mainly over summer, basically, when people fish the salmon here. And some rivers, it's very popular. Overall, as a thing, the numbers seem to be really declining, which, you know, is a worldwide trend, I think. Well, yes. It's certainly a Scottish trend that the number of wild salmon are decreasing. So there's some concern in some of the rivers. For example, where I did my cross Scotland route, I swam in Loch Maree, which is a beautiful big loch and has these islands with ancient Caledonian wood trees, pine trees growing on them. So these really thickly wooded islands, really ancient trees, and then around the loch, not so many trees on the shore. A loch that barely has any salmon in now, but used to be very popular and people would go up there on holiday to fish for. But now people barely fish at all there, and there was a film done about the decline of the salmon there at least. So yeah, it's something that's of a concern. But yes, illegal on a Sunday. It would make it a lot easier because there's potentially a very popular river, the River Conin, for fishing. And I think I saw about two or three people as I swam down that day, so it's very quiet.
Yeah, that's really nice. We don't have anything like that here. It's like size limits and, you know, quantity limits. There's not like a specific day where you cannot go out and fish.
Yeah,
I kind of like that idea a lot. It would make traffic, right, like a lot better on the water.
Totally. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not exclusively for boat use then, but it makes it a lot easier if you want to go, you know, take a boat down a river on a Sunday or take watercraft of some kind. Yeah, it makes it a lot easier because you know there's not going to be salmon fishing, at least. There can be other types of fishing depending where you are. But yeah, I think it may go back to, you know, potentially a more religious kind of based thing that you're not doing things on a Sunday, which would be, you know, in the past and lots of Scotland. But I think it's quite good as well. It gives the river a rest and it gives the fish a break too, so they're not constantly being fished.
So when you're towing your packs behind you, where are you putting the line? Is it just right around your waist?
Yeah, I think I was going to grab one and show you, but I have got one here. This might not work for the podcast, but I'll show you anyway. So I've got a bright orange waist belt here.
Okay.
Which comes with most of these tow floats you buy, these big inflatable bright floats that you pull behind you. And so, yeah, it's just a really strong, colourful belt. And just on that, I've got line of paracord. And so I just tow that behind me. It's really visible in the water as well, which when I tow my bag, it's a massive, big orange thing, so you can't miss it really. So I don't have to carry another tow float with me. But yeah, as simple as that. I sometimes have used a surf leash in the past on my ankle, but again, that's like when you're trying it early on and working out what works and what doesn't work. It does work, but it's much harder to swim when you've got something pulling you on your ankle, but in your waist it's a lot easier. You barely feel it. As long as your bag floats on top of the water, it's not too heavy. If you're carrying, like, I don't know, if you're carrying diving weights or something, that's going to be a lot harder as your bag's going to be sitting in the water more than on the water.
Right. Do you kick your paracord line at all? Like, that's what I was kind of envisioning. Do you have to adjust your kicking at all when you're towing that?
Not really. No, I think as long as it's long enough, you're not kicking your bag. If your bag's too close to you, you'll definitely kick your bag. I've got tangled up in a couple of times, but I'm also I don't really kick very much when I swim. I'm a very lazy kicker in a way. So unless I'm like going for a sprint, I don't really kick very often. And no, yeah, it just sits at a really good angle away from you. Are you tempted to try it yourself?
Yes, I am. I live in Florida. There's water everywhere. I mostly go play in the ocean, but we have a spot where I could go and it's like, it would just be like mangrove islands. And I'm like, and it's not far. It's really not a far swim to cross it. So, but I do have to be cognizant of the current because we live close to the inlet and the current can be very, very strong. So,
yeah,
and we have a lot of boaters. So time of day and current would play into that. But yeah, I'm curious about it. But I'm curious about your hike packing too, and like actually like swimming along with it. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I think we're very lucky. I mean, I've done most of these journeys in Scotland, and we're very lucky in Scotland in terms of the freedom we've got to. You can almost just choose where you want to go, and you can go there. So in terms of like accessing land and accessing water, it's really, really good in Scotland. And when I do these journeys in freshwater and also at the sea, depending where you are in the sea, there's some bits of Scotland that are very straightforward. And then again, just like you're saying, there's some bits that have ridiculous currents and involve a lot more planning, and some places I wouldn't go at all to swim in without a safety boat, for example. So yeah, I think we're very lucky here as well because we've got such a variety of places and things you can do. And also we're a very small country, so it doesn't take a long time to get from one side to the other and experience, you know, like a different, for example, I live far from the sea in Scotland, and it's only about an hour and a half away. So in terms of like America, for example, that would be considered probably not that far at all, depending where you are. So yeah.
That's funny. You live in the Highlands, right?
Yeah, almost. I live in Aberfeldy, which is Perthshire. It's the Highlands, and it's slap bang in the middle of Scotland, just about.
Okay. And isn't that kind of the definition of the Highlands, is like the higher land in the middle of the country?
Not so much, actually. The Highlands, it's considered that the northern part of the country, and it's where most of the mountains are, but it's basically, we work out along the Highland boundary fault line, which is like a geographic fault line that runs partly through Loch Lomond, one of the biggest lochs in Scotland, and anything north of that we consider the Highlands, basically.
Okay, so it's not just the center, it's the northern part, and it has to be Highland, truly in the mountains. I figured with the name Highland, it had to be up high.
It's where most of the mountains are, so most of the Highland is in the Highlands. But okay. Not all the Highlands are high, if you know what I mean.
Okay, that makes sense. So you just talked about access, and that's really interesting to me. You did a hike that was 4 days. You did the longest line, which I think is a really cool concept of just hiking in a line without crossing any roads for 4 days. I can't imagine that there's that many places in the world that you could really do that. And I'm curious, because I did watch the video and it really just looked like wide open spaces. There was no there's no fences that you had to worry about, or like it looked like private property really at all. So what is access like there?
Good, really good question. Yeah, because I often, when you live somewhere, you forget what it's like in other places maybe. So in Scotland, yes, lots of the land, we talk about it in the context of this longest line walk. It's quite good because I can tell you exactly where we were. So we started, if you imagine taking a compass bearing and walking on it for 50 miles, that's basically what we did. But we used GPS. And we're crossing across a variety of land that's either owned by private estates. So that's, you know, potentially one person owns this huge acres and acres of land, or it could be a company owns it, or it could be charities own part of it. So conservation charities own part of it, you know, every few miles, potentially crossing over different owners of land. But in Scotland, we have the right to responsible access. So that means as long as you are being responsible, so you're basically not making a mess, you're not breaking anything, you're not endangering anyone, and you're not taking a motor vehicle either, you can go anywhere you like. It's almost, people would call it the right to roam, and it is that, but you've got to be responsible in your access. That's what you have to take on board when you go to these places. So yeah, a lot of where we crossed, I don't think we had to climb a fence. We had to climb maybe one fence. And then we reached a point where we could either go through a gate or keep on going and climb a fence. We went through the gate just to, you know, be more responsible about our access. So it probably took us off the line by like a meter or so. But yeah, we are very lucky in terms of we've got access to go to these places. In terms of like how the land is used, that can almost be down to the owner of the land. So that's a really big issue in Scotland in terms of, you know, conservation, in terms of, so for example, the land we started on, beside the road, we walked up this hill, it was covered in heather, so thick, small bushes, really rough, hard going on steep, even on small slopes, it's hard going because you have to really pull yourself up these slopes. And a lot of that used land is used for grouse shooting. So effectively, these grouse, which are small birds, are kind of reared on the land, and then people pay quite a lot of money to come and shoot them as a sport. So there's people that do that. I've never done it myself, not something I'm interested in doing. But as we passed further into other parts of, it was all within the Cairngorms National Park as well, Scotland's biggest national park. We passed through areas that are now owned for the purposes of conservation and rewilding. So bringing landscapes back to maybe a more, you know, natural state, as you could call it. So replanting lots of trees, for example, but some areas not even doing that much tree planting, just taking the number of deer, which eat lots of different things in Scotland. It's got lots and lots of deer roaming around. They eat lots and lots of plants. So by taking the numbers of deer down in some of these areas, it allows plants to just naturally regenerate. So it was really interesting seeing the difference in land usage. For example, we walked for 4 days and we didn't really go through a forest until right at the end. You know, depending where you are in the world, you might have to walk through forest for 4 days to do that kind of thing. But in Scotland, it was a lot of open moorland and kind of boggy ground. So yeah, it was really interesting to see that, and I think we're very lucky in the access we got. But in terms of the ownership, there's still lots of questions. You know, anyone could just come and buy land and effectively decide what they want to do with it, mm-hmm. you know, without having anyone to answer to some extent. Mm-hmm. So there's it creates a lot of conflict within Scotland, but I think it's a really interesting topic.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. So here we have, I mean, private property rights sound like they're pretty important over there, right? So like if you own the property, you get to say what you get to do with it. And that's very similar here as well, and you know, similar conservation versus development and kind of finding that balance, right? But private property, people that there's no right to roam here. Like if they catch you on their property, they're not happy about it. So I think that's a really cool concept. And maybe it's because people abused it, right? Like abused that right to roam here and they didn't protect it, or, you know, they just weren't good visitors, good guests. But I really like that concept a lot.
Yeah, I was in America in October, I think it was 2019. And I remember where we were staying in Vermont. We were kind of staying up a hill, almost up a mountain. And the number of signs, I couldn't believe it, you know, just in what looked like, you know, you're driving along. It was a very rough road. I wouldn't call it a road, but like it looked like just like a forest. So in Scotland, I'd be like, oh, I'll go in here and have a look, see what, you know, might be nice, something nice to see. But the number of signs, I couldn't believe it. Yeah, because there's nothing stopping you going in to the forest other than this sign and the warning of, you know, what could happen to you. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think Scotland could be a good example for lots of other places around the world. And also lots of the Scandinavian countries are also very good examples in the same way. They've got really good access. Yeah, I think a lot of it might come down to a mindset initially. I mean, I don't know, you know, get to changing that way of being.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know either. It would be really cool though to have that much access, because there's a lot that's owned but not really used that could just be, you know, roamed upon.
Yeah. I think used in all sorts of ways, you know, used for recreation, used for conservation, used for like education. People, I mean, I think especially in this day and age, I think really people need to have the ability to get to outdoors places and to be within nature and to have that access, whether it's, you know, whether it's to inland places, whether it's to the coast, whether it's to the sea. Yeah, I think that is really important. And it's interesting because Scotland in that respect is very different to the rest of the UK, particularly England. Much harder, you know, private land laws. You can't just, if you saw a nice beach on a map, you're not allowed to just walk there. You'd have to work out if there's a public access way or not. You know, it could be private land which you're not allowed to cross. In Scotland, you could just, you know, work out a safe way of getting there and go there. So that's also really interesting.
Wait, so just getting to the beach is the problem, or like you don't even know if you could walk on that beach because it might be a private beach?
Both. Yeah, both. So you might not be able to get there, and then the beach itself. So if the land, including the beach, I'm not quite sure how it works in terms of the coast, because once you reach the water, you could be in the water, no problem at all. So I don't quite know where the boundary is. But actually getting to the beach, if it's private land surrounding it that you're not allowed to walk on in England, yeah, you might actually not be able to get there in the first place, unless you have a kayak or swim round or something, you know?
Right. The water workaround.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's similar here, but once you're on the beach, I think in Florida, the beaches are pretty much public access. You can't be like, this is private property. But I think throughout the whole country, if you're in the tidal zone, then you're in the water effectively.
Yeah.
So you're good. But that's interesting. Yeah. Access isn't something you really think about until you go and try to explore nature. And you're right. It's something that all of us really could benefit from. And yeah, I'm wondering if access might become more of a topic.
Yeah, I think so. Especially like people who, so I live basically in the country in a village, but if you live in a big city and you're not used to maybe, you know, accessing wild places or accessing the countryside, you might not feel it's for you in a way. So I'm keen for people too, who are not used to, you know, being outdoors and maybe are stuck in urban places, to have the opportunity to get out as well, and to understand that they have the right and the opportunity to do cool stuff and to be in nature as well, effectively.
Yeah. What's the difference between Scotland and Australia? How are the access laws there?
Oh, I'm not totally sure about Australia, to be honest.
Sounds like you spent lots of time there, so I was curious if you knew.
Yeah, I don't, I'm not totally sure. I think Australia, there's lots of private land, but there's also so much of Australia is just effectively open. And for the size of place, the population is so small, you can actually go and do a lot of things. So I'm not totally sure. Yeah, don't know.
Okay. So one of the funniest videos, and I think it's kind of one of the things that launched your online presence, is your Scottish water temperature from roasting to Baltic.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through your different levels of temperature and what's your favorite?
Yeah, I think it's funny because like I made that video a few years ago, and like I get heckled in the supermarket with people who've seen it and stuff like that. So it was I think it was very funny because It was, I don't like to take outdoor swimming and everything, I don't like to take it all too seriously at times. So that's right. What the video was trying to reflect. What's my, so the scale, well, here's, you put me on the spot there. The scale changes. It changes in how I feel. But basically it goes from.
Well, what's it today?
Oh, it's decent. Yeah. Oh, it's a summer in Scotland, so the temperature is decent. It's not painful once you get into the water, so it's actually quite nice. Yeah, it's pleasant. It's decent. So it's roasting. So roasting is, you'll get this a couple times a year in Scotland. It's not quite roasting yet. On a really hot day, at least the top layer of water gets roasting, so it's very pleasant. You know, you can swim there for hours. Roasting. If it's not roasting, though, it's decent. Which is basically what we're in right now. So again, it's not painful to get in. You actually can get in and have fun without a wetsuit. You just enjoy your swim and you can relax in the water. And then if it's not decent, it's no bad, which is basically means it's not going to, yeah, it's not going to cause you feet real pain when you get in. I mean, it's a kind of, it's when it surprises you that it, oh, it's not bad actually. Yeah. When you're expecting it to be really cold. And if it's not, no bad, it's all right explains it, because you get into the water, so I'm going to go for a wee swim and someone asks me what's it like, and I would say aye, it's all right, and they'd be like aye, all right, aye. So that kind of explains, I mean, what like actual number you'd put beside that, I don't know, it depends on who you are, but usually it's cold, so for like, I don't know, 70% of the year is going to be cold in Scotland. And that's pretty self-explanatory. You know, you get in the water. It's hard work when it's cold, but it is quite enjoyable as well. But it's not quite as bad as when it's Baltic. And Baltic is how we have it for like 3 months of the year, maybe, in fresh water. It's just painful. You know, it's the actual, the hardest bit is getting into the water and convincing your mind that you can do it. So you've often got ice on the edge of the water, maybe. The sea can also be Baltic, because it's just the part of being Baltic, I think, is also just the mindset of it being a cold, really windy day, for example. So just you're standing there with all your clothes on, you're like, I do not want to get my clothes off. the psychological trick of it makes it more Baltic. My favourite, see, I don't have a favourite, because I enjoy the seasons. So I enjoy the fact we get really cold water in winter. And I'm not quite looking forward to it yet. I'm still enjoying what we've got here in the summer, and it's going to get a little warmer still. But I enjoy that it changes and that it's not the same thing all the time. I think, I don't know if I could handle that, you know, as much as I'd love to swim like in a beautiful sunny place. And I do enjoy that when I go on holiday or sometimes in Scotland. I would get bored of it. You know, I'd want the change. I'd want the flowers. I'd want the colours on the trees to turn that kind of orange gold we get in autumn, which is like an amazing experience when you see that all around you. And the water's still not cold, but you get all the leaves turning this beautiful golden colour and then falling off. And then it's much bleaker in winter, but it makes you more resilient to some extent. You know, the days are short, so you've got to make the most of it when you go for your swim. You've just got to get on with it and got to do it. So I don't have a favourite in that way. I enjoy how it changes, and you've just got to embrace that change as well, which makes you appreciate the whole sport or the whole hobby even more. Have you tried kind of Baltic water yourself?
No. You know what? I have dove in a dry suit. That's okay. Like, I've chipped ice off the boat and dove in a dry suit for work. I was doing oyster restoration. But I was like dying. Like, I'm from Florida. It's very warm where I grew up and then where we currently live now. But, you know, I've discovered Wim Hof in the last couple of years, like since I've done this. And I'm like, you know, there's lots of benefits. It puts you outside your comfort zone. There's lots of benefits to it. So I'm like, maybe I'll try it again without the dry suit.
I think so. It's almost like a different experience to swimming in summer. It's almost like not swimming very often. Very often winter, it's just about feeling the cold and getting that buzz and then getting out before you get too cold. I enjoy it. I enjoy how it changes, and I also enjoy the challenge of it. Just, you know, if I can do any distance in the cold water, what can I do? So I do like that aspect too.
How often do you swim?
Almost every single day.
Okay. Even in the winter? Even when it's Baltic?
Yeah. Although sometimes in winter, I have to admit, I'm only in for maybe a couple of minutes. So whether you actually can call it swimming is debatable sometimes.
Plunging.
Yeah, sometimes it's that pretty much every day. Sometimes I won't manage it just because of physically, like, I'll be away with work in a city where it's harder to get access to somewhere outdoors, because I sometimes swim indoors, only really if it's an interesting place or I've got an event I need to train for or something. So most days, I've tried, I think, 3 or 4 times to swim every single day for a year, and I've always managed to get to, like, just over a month, and then something's come up and I've not managed it, or I've been ill or something. And, you know, once you break the chain, you give up. So, right. I mean, I've got a friend in Australia who's been swimming for 3,000 days nonstop. Obviously, he does other stuff with his life, but he's managed to get in a swim for, what's that, also getting towards 8 years or something.
Isn't that like 9 years?
Yeah, something mad like that. So, yeah, so he's managed at least a swim on the day for part of the day, yeah.
Good for him. That's cool. So have you kind of like created your own community of friends that are just all like outdoor swimmers? Sounds like I got a friend in Australia that does this. Like, I'm sure you have friends in Scotland that do it with you too, right?
Yes. It's such a kind of global community, swimming. I think because it's some of the people, I mean, I've never actually met the guy in Australia in real life, Peter, okay. But we're friends online. And of course, I've got that slight Aussie connection as well, I think, which helps. But I think because we've all got this shared love of something we enjoy doing, and often we enjoy doing it in the same way. I mean, I've got friends who I'll swim with here in Scotland, but then I've got a friend in Switzerland. In fact, might be coming over to do some swim trekking with me later this year. Cool. So friends all around the world. I think, I don't know about, I mean, at least within the UK, within Scotland and England and Wales and Northern Ireland, the number of people actually swimming in the last couple of years has just shot up, like, hugely. People swimming outdoors, you know, I think it's connected to people wanting to get closer to nature, and especially after the lockdown and last couple of years, people wanting and appreciating the outdoors a lot more. So that's added hugely, I think, to the numbers over the last couple of years.
And your involvement with the Outdoor Swimming Society probably helps find some friends that are keen on swimming and kind of garnering that support too.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm an ambassador for the Outdoor Swimming Society, who, I guess, we're based in the UK, most of the people who are involved in the organization, but effectively the organization is just all about encouraging people to swim outdoors, and then to also start taking steps to increase the provision or the availability to swim outdoors, especially, for example, in England, where the access is not good. But doing that through a variety of ways, a lot of it to encourage people to do it and challenge themselves, but in also think about safety and taking it on in a safe way, and, you know, learning about your body. And you're never an expert overnight, you know. So I've been swimming outdoors for like 12 years or something. I'm learning new stuff all the time and still making mistakes all the time, but I've made lots of mistakes that I've learned from in the past. So I think, yeah, through the OSS as well, it's really become a big global community as well as anything.
Yeah. And you've written a book to help people kind of mitigate some of these mistakes that you've made, right?
Yeah, don't make the same mistakes as me. I mean, I don't talk about all the mistakes in the book. Sometimes I don't like to publicize all the mistakes I've made to some extent, but learning through experience is a brilliant way to learn, I have to say. But you don't have to do it always. 1001 Outdoor Swimming Tips is the name of my book. It's based, the publishers, Vertebrate Publishing, have a series called 1001 Tips, covering all sorts of different sports, so climbing, running, cycling, and they've got all sorts of other ones coming out later this year. And I was asked to do the outdoor swimming one. Yeah, I was delighted to say yes, because I'd had an idea in my mind, maybe would I like to write a book? Because I've written quite a few articles, and I write lots of scripts, at least for when I do TV stuff or make videos and things like that. So I'd had an idea, could I do a book? Would I do a book? I was delighted to do it. It's kind of like a guidebook, and it's got lots of tips, 1001 tips. I mean, it does what it says on the tin, it does what it says on the book. It's got over 1001 tips, how to be a better swimmer, how to think of safety, mixed in with, so it's not just a big list of do this, do that, do this, do that, mixed in with ideally inspiring people you know, as mm-hmm. well, to think about swimming differently, to think about water differently in a way, you know, to consider. Mm-hmm. I always, anytime I see some water, I think, you know, could I go for a swim here? Could I swim mm-hmm. across here? You know, what's to be seen under the water? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. So it encourages people to think in that way and become more adventurous in their swimming too. So you're not just, you know, yeah, to expand what you think you're capable of doing.
So if somebody has never done an outdoor swim before, what would you tell them? They're actually keen on trying it.
I'd say, good on you. I would say start ideally when the weather is, wherever you live, when the weather's not at its coldest, but to some extent, it doesn't really matter. If you want to start today, go for it wherever you are. Location is a big thing, so choosing somewhere that you can get in and out of the water easily or safely is a big thing. So whether that's, you know, a lake where, you know, you can walk in where the water gets gently deeper, whether it's the sea, you know, try and find a place that people swim at regularly. So if people are swimming there regularly, there's a good chance it's going to be a safer place, or somewhere, maybe lots of places have lifeguarded areas you can go swimming. I mean, in Scotland, I think we've got maybe three. It's not a big thing in Scotland so much. And also then find experience from people who already do it. So whether you've got a friend, there's a good chance you might know someone who's already doing it, who's maybe just got into it in the last couple of years. Lots and lots and lots of places have local swim groups, whether it's, some places have organized clubs, you know, through swimming clubs, but lots of places just have groups who meet up informally, but they'll have a huge amount of knowledge and a huge amount of experience to, you know, to point you in the right way, to keep you safe. Take someone else along with you for the first time, whether they're actually going to go for a swim or whether they're just going to stay on the side and, you know, make sure you've got dry stuff to get on after you. And I would say as well, for your first time, just take it really easy. You know, choose somewhere that you don't have to go to deep water for a swim. Because if you're a very confident swimmer, then you obviously know what you're doing. But if you're a confident swimmer, it's a good chance you've probably swum outdoors at some point. So if you wouldn't consider yourself a strong swimmer, or you don't know that you are, even, you know, you're maybe not sure, choose somewhere where you don't have to go into deep water and that's not got a current that's going to pull you away somewhere. Because, you know, once you're almost your chest deep, that's deep enough to go swimming, you have a great swim. You know, whether it's distance you want to do, swim up and down the coast, whether you want to just actually be in the water, enjoy the experience of it, and get out before you start getting cold. Some places, obviously, people are going to be swimming in warm water, maybe where you are in Florida. But get out, you know, maybe sooner than you expected for the first time. Just process it, how it all felt, what you could do better, what you could do differently. And for example, do you wear a wetsuit? Do you not? Do you wear something on your feet? Do you not? It depends where you are and depends who you are. Some people really need to wear wetsuits. Some people can't stand wearing wetsuits. You know, if you've got the opportunity to wear one for the first time, I'd say go for it. And maybe at the end of your swim, take it off for a couple of minutes, see how the water feels just on your skin. And then from there, you can start to make decisions. You're gaining experience all the time and you're making yourself a better swimmer with every kind of time you go to the water.
Great advice. So I'm curious for you, what determines if you wear a wetsuit or not? Because I have seen videos of you swimming without a wetsuit in ice.
Loads of factors.
Okay.
Yeah, there's loads of factors that take into account. Usually in ice, I wouldn't wear a wetsuit because I'm going to get cold anyway, you know, in a wetsuit or without. It definitely would make me last longer. But when it comes to ice, I know I'm not going to be in the water for a long time, no matter what. So wearing a wetsuit, it's going to let me swim for longer. But because I'm only going to be in a short time, I just, the faff of getting changed and then, you know, stripping off a wetsuit and then getting cold afterwards with the wind, for example, yeah, I'd probably just not bother. Maybe if I want to go for a longer swim and I'm on my own, for example, a swim packing trip where it's a bit more committing and I don't have anyone looking out for me, then I'll wear a wetsuit to keep me warmer and also to make me a stronger, quicker swimmer. It totally depends. It depends on what I want to get out of the swim as well. You know, if I'm taking photos, I'll probably wear a wetsuit because I'm going to be in the water for longer, or treading water. Yeah, it's kind of things I think it through in my head, what I want to get out of it before I get in the water.
Well, that's a good explanation. Yeah, that makes sense. It would just be totally dependent on the situation and what you wanted to get out of it. Not necessarily the water temperature.
That water temperature definitely plays a big part. So I think, I don't quite know where the cutoff line, maybe, you know, a mile or so, anything above a mile. Still at this point of year, I'm not always wearing a wetsuit by now. But as it gets into summer, if I'm swimming maybe 2 kilometres or around about a mile, anything longer than that, I will wear a wetsuit until later in the year. And then, you know, you get acclimatized to it, you get habituated to the colder water, so you can strip it off and swim for longer. So, yeah, and as you're swimming throughout the year, you feel the water's getting warmer. Also, it totally depends on location. Some locations, it could be, you know, very close to each other, could be a change of 3 to 4 degrees Celsius, which is quite a big jump sometimes. So, things like that, all sorts of factors to take into account, really.
Awesome. I feel like I would be remiss not to ask, because you have one loch that's super famous worldwide. Have you ever swam in Loch Ness?
I have. And it's interesting you ask, because are you on TikTok at all?
No.
No. So I joined TikTok, I think it was earlier this year or last year. But anyway, I posted up a video yesterday or the day before on TikTok, not in Loch Ness, but in Loch Morar, which is the deepest loch in Scotland. Anyway, this video has gone ridiculous and it's got 12.5 million views now.
What?
It's absolutely mad. And it's just me in the middle of the loch talking to the camera, because it's the deepest water we've got in the whole of the UK, the deepest water in Scotland, 310 metres, which is about 1,000 feet.
1,000 feet, that's substantial.
But, yeah, but now I feel like, oh, I have to go and do a follow-up. So Loch Ness, I've actually swum quite a lot in Loch Ness, because I used to live very close to it. And so I'm going to go back and swim there either tomorrow or Wednesday. It's a couple of hours up the road from where I am. And it's funny because Loch Ness is so famous, like right around the world, you get loads of tourists coming each year. But growing up beside it, it was not the most exciting. And even, I think, to a lot of visitors, it might be slightly underwhelming, because it's huge, it's very long, but it's not that dramatic looking, maybe, unless once you start hearing the stories about the amount of water it's got in it, and there's lots of stories connected around it, and of course the famous Nessie, the Loch Ness monster as well. I think a lot of these things capture the imagination. Once you add all these things in, if you turned up and looked at it without knowing anything about it, you might just think, oh, it's not the most exciting. Growing up, I think I wasn't that fussed by it, but in the last couple of years, I've really explored it a lot more, and I've really explored lots of new bits that I'd never been to, because it's round about 20 odd miles long. It's got so many interesting bits of coastline that you can go and swim from. It's very cold, and it does get very deep. So it's not one I kind of recommend for lots of new swimmers, unless they're used to cold water. But there's so many interesting little bits to it. I found during the first lockdown, I found a really good place where you could run and jump off a pier. I've paddleboarded the length of the loch. Also, just like once we got a bit of freedom from the first COVID lockdown, I was like, right, what can I do that's still on my doorstep? So I paddleboarded the length of it, and I've packrafted across it and swum all sorts of bits of it. I've not swum the length of it yet, although I've got friends that have done that. I've swum across it. I think I've done across it. So yeah, and I've not yet seen Nessie though. Not yet.
She hasn't made an appearance, huh?
No, but maybe when I go and swim there tomorrow or Wednesday, maybe she will show up. That'd be make a good
video. She'll give you a ride. She's like, let's do this whole thing. We'll give you a ride.
Yeah, I can set a new record or something for it, surely.
Very cool. Alrighty. Well, at the end of each episode, I can't believe an hour has passed so fast. I've enjoyed chatting with you. I like to ask a series of questions. And this is going to be interesting chatting with you. What is your favorite sea creature? And why?
My favourite sea creature? You know, growing up, actually, when I was just leaving school, the title of your podcast was, you want to be a marine biologist? Basically, I did want to be a marine biologist when I left school. I didn't do anything about it, though. I never pursued it. So who knows?
Why?
It was an idea I had, but I never followed it up. And I don't know for sure why. I think I could never see a path into it. At least in Scotland. Although now we have the UHI, the University of the Highlands and Islands, which has SAMS, the Scottish
Association of Marine Science. I just had somebody on the podcast fairly recently from
there
SAMS.
You go. Yeah, yeah, and so they offer a course. So yeah, I think I could maybe who knows what the future holds. You know, I could go back and do something. As a slight digression from the answer, I think a turtle. I think the turtle might be my favourite sea creature, because on a visit back to Australia, I was staying on an island in the kind of inner Great Barrier Reef, Great Keppel Island, and we'd swim. I was working as a gardener for a week. But I just worked there so I could stay there, and we'd swim in the sea pretty much every day. And there was a turtle which we'd heard about kind of coming around the beach. We heard about it for 2 or 3 days, never saw it swimming every day. And then one day we're out swimming snorkels and the turtle came past, and I had what was my first underwater camera at the time. So again, that was kind of where my love for photography was still growing then, and my love for taking photos in water. And I managed to swim down and snap a photo of the turtle as it swam kind of below us. Mm-hmm. And that's a really strong memory for me, for like seeing animals and being in the sea as well. Maybe even more so than seeing anything in Scotland, but also because I'd never seen one. I'd never seen one before, which, you know, really stuck with me. Like when you see something for the first time, which obviously you've seen videos of and you've seen pictures of. I think that would have to be my favorite. And as well as that, the speed it went at was just unreal. You know, for such a large creature, which in a way didn't look that, you know, gain. Well, obviously in the water it was very quick, but yeah, it just looked at us, and when it had had enough of us, it just shot away. So yeah, I think that would be probably be my favorite. That, and I really love otters. So we've got lots of otters in Scotland, which live in both seawater and freshwater. They go between the two, but I really like them because they're great to watch. Because they're very playful as well, and they'll often be with their family. You know, I've seen a whole family of them together, like what I assume are the parents and three small ones as well. And when you see them eating, they lie on their back with the food sometimes on their chest, and they'll lie there eating, and they'll sleep lying on their back holding hands with one another. So yeah, I really like otters as well because they're quite somewhat iconic to Scotland in a way. So I really like them too, and I've seen so many of them as well.
Yeah, otters are super cute, and I have a soft spot for turtles. They did a lot of sea turtle work too.
Okay, cool.
Actually, something I wanted to ask you, I'm really curious about. You were born in Australia and you spent a lot of time there, and I understand like you spent the majority of your life in Scotland as well. How did you learn Gaelic?
Yeah, I was born in Australia. My family, half of them are from... So my mum's side are all Australian and my dad's side are Scottish. So his side they're from various places, but his side of the family always spoke Gaelic on his father's side. They're from Applecross, which is a small place on the west coast of Scotland. So we grew it speaking up. So I've lived in Scotland since I was 18 months old, and I've only ever spoken Gaelic to my dad. So it would be weird to speak English to him in the same way, you know, once you have that relationship with someone in one language, to change to another can be odd. So although within Scotland that's quite an unusual thing, you know, the number of Gaelic speakers is still very small compared to the whole population. Grew up speaking it and did it through school as well, so I just always have spoken it. I think because we spoke it at home, me and my sister, it made give a lot more opportunity compared to some people who maybe do it through school but don't speak it at home. So that's the reason why I like to use it a lot on social media and encourage other people to use it, and make lots of my videos through it. And I guess once you speak Gaelic, you understand so much more about Scotland. I'd really try and use it as well to I mean, for example, if I go swimming a loch, straight away I'm speaking Gaelic there. The word loch is Gaelic. So yeah, straight away I like most of the names of the lochs are all in Gaelic. So I like to kind of explain these things to people as well. It's a big part of my identity as well as my work and what I enjoy doing.
It's very cool. I really enjoy your Gaelic videos. It was really cool to hear because it's not something that we're exposed to here in the US very much. So it's awesome.
Yeah. No, thanks a lot. Yeah, I mean, even within Scotland, most people would go about the day and never hear it really. So yeah, so I really like to put it in front of people if I can. Yeah.
What does the ocean mean to you?
I think it means lots of things. It means lots of memories. So lots of memories of growing up and visiting Applecross on the west coast. So going out in my dad's little boat, you know, to some of the small islands just around the coast, fishing off the pier there. But also means freedom to some extent. So yeah, lots of my strongest or best memories are from like journeys over the sea, or there's one I can never forget, which was taking a boat out to St. Kilda, which is a group of islands 40 miles off the west coast of Scotland, like sit right out in the ocean by themselves. And I just remember the boat journey taken out there a number of years ago now. We stayed out there for a couple of days, but yeah, seeing sunfish on the way over, seeing dolphins, and but just being out there, I think it must have been the furthest I've been from shore. So you're probably 20 miles all directions, no land in the middle of it. And just like trying to comprehend the sheer size of it was just quite mind-boggling, because you almost lose sight of land, not quite, from both sides, but you certainly can't see the islands until you're much closer to them. So yeah, the sense of freedom, that really stuck with me, and I think that's a big part of it for me. I think where I live, I miss the sea where I live, like, because I'm an hour and a half away. I don't make the effort to go, you know, to the sea, obviously not every day, but sometimes I'll go a couple of weeks without getting to the sea. And when I do get there, usually to the west coast, it's much better in Scotland than the east coast. Yeah, I feel much calmer, more relaxed. Yeah, I think longer term, I'd like to be living by the sea, you know, and make it, you know, part of daily life, ideally.
More so than the Highlands. It seems like you really enjoy swimming in the freshwater looks.
The Highlands would be just the north of Scotland. So the sea, the huge, most interesting parts of the sea are in the Highlands of Scotland, as it were. Okay. Yeah, so ideally, I live at the bottom of a mountain beside the sea with a river coming down, and then I can take a run into the mountains, and there's a nice loch there, and I can do a journey where I run up the mountain, swim in the loch, swim down the river, swim in the sea, and go home before breakfast. That's the ideal life for me.
That sounds perfect. Yeah. I love it. Very cool. All right. If you were given a blank check, unlimited funds for a project or projects up to three, what would you use the monies for?
This question really stumped me. I mean, I don't know for sure. I think, one, if I was to do a massive project, it would be some way of course, world peace. That's the big one. There we go. But some way of, like, I don't know, democratizing, like, income or wealth a lot more. So that would be building an infrastructure that makes it possible that, yeah, you can never earn too much money, and you don't want to earn too much money, ideally. But then people who are out there doing the work that creates wealth for, you know, very rich people, you know, doing everyday jobs, get paid a better wage. So it's creating an infrastructure. So that's not necessarily connected to the ocean as such, although it would affect everything on Earth. But yeah, creating an infrastructure that allows that to happen would be the big one. A slightly smaller topic, maybe the mid-range one, would be some way of, I'm interested in, like, actually, like, you know, I go to the beach and I pick up rubbish, but stopping that happening in the first place. So getting, again, it's almost like creating systems, or like whether you have to create a mindset shift somehow, but creating a system that stops so much rubbish going in the ocean in the first place, so that we don't have to then go to a beach and pick up rubbish. So we don't have to go and, you know, put the effort in to take stuff out, which never should have been there in the first place. Right. Because I've done quite a bit of that, you know, going to a beach and picking up rubbish. And yeah, that's really quite frustrating and annoying, especially because some place in Scotland you go, you'll see no rubbish at all, and you think, wow, we live in this amazing country. Just around the corner, it would be full of litter and full of waste and junk. And, you know, I think we've got it pretty good here compared to lots of other parts of the world. So that would be that. I think for an even smaller topic, well, I guess maybe it's not connected to the sea, but it's a personal aim of mine. I would like to see, whether it needs a big budget, I don't know, but I'd like to see a way of encouraging people to either learn Scottish Gaelic, so people, it's just mainly been in Scotland, but you could be anywhere in the world, to learn it, but also to stop it, to continue it passing on through generations, which is like a big issue, intergenerational transmission of languages. In fact, it happens in huge amount of minority languages around the world. Yeah, where we live in an English-speaking world, so you can't avoid it, obviously, but where the passing of a language, or even often a culture as well, stops through generations. So really encouraging, finding a way to keep that going, you know, to obviously embrace the world we live in, you know, embrace the wider world and other cultures, but also to keep your own one going at the same time. So to get more people pass on Gaelic, for example, that's what I speak, to their children, and encourage it that way. And I think that'd be a great way to, you know, to make us appreciate, even you can also start to appreciate nature so much more, because wherever you are in the world, people who have lived there for a long time maybe have used plants in a particular way, and you know, will have their own words for it that aren't the English or the Latin name for it, and that might relate to the usage of it or something. And so you can understand more about nature and, you know, live better with nature in that way. So I think it's all connected in that way, but that's the step I would take as part of a bigger project. Yeah,
I do think that's important for people to kind of like recognize their ancestry and honor that, and you know, live in the world that we live in, right? But to bring those customs and cultures, because yeah, ancestral customs and cultures are a little bit more connected to nature than our current system, and that's kind of what we're lacking right now.
Yeah, I think so. I think me personally, when I visit somewhere new, you know, I want to find out about like the people there and the place there, and I don't just want to go and like eat McDonald's wherever I go, or like, you know, I don't want to be, you know, in Scotland in another part of the world. You know, I want to experience the differences. I mean, that's what makes it more fun, that places are different and that people do things differently. Yeah.
Great three projects.
Yeah. So, yeah.
They would change the world. They would.
Hey, there we go. Yeah. Sorted it. Well, maybe not sorted it, but taking a step towards it.
What is your favorite field story or stories to tell? And this could just be like the most amazing epic swim or, you know, hike. Or it could just be a time where things happened and it makes a really great story now.
I think, so when I film things and I tell stories, I like stories where stuff goes wrong, maybe. Like, I think it's much more interesting when things are going wrong. Like, if you're making a film, like, film the stuff that goes wrong. It's always the best story, which I've failed to do myself a few times. But anyway, yeah, it's a very kind of small occasion, small story, but also relates, I think, interestingly to social media. So I post quite a lot on social media. I try and avoid social media as much as I can when I'm not posting, but sometimes you know, get dragged into scrolling. But anyway, it's a really good thing for getting your message out there, sharing the word and all sorts of things, but it can also be really bad for just like stealing your attention. So I feel very conflicted. But anyway, this story combines my love of wild placing, swimming, and also social media. My girlfriend and I, we went to visit a small island just off the north of Scotland called Stroma. And Stroma is really kind of wild, huge seabird population there. People used to live there until the 60s, but it just became too hard to live there. And so they left. So there's a few houses and there's an old school and people keep sheep there still. It's very quiet. You know, so the way you get there, it's not a tourist place. We had to speak to the local crofter, or that's like a farmer who keeps the sheep there. He took us out and he said, right, I'll pick you up in 6 hours or whatever it was. You just go roam the island and roam these effectively abandoned buildings and empty cliffs and beaches and rough rocky beaches. Nothing, it's not pristine, it's not nice. It's quite a rugged place. You're out near the Pentland Firth, which is some of the strongest water in the whole of the UK. Really strong tidal pull there. And of course, being as an island surrounded by sea, I was like, well, I want to go for a swim at some point. So we were on the east coast, looking out towards the ocean, kind of towards the Orkney Islands. And you could see the movement of the water in the distance, really powerful. And I was just having a swim in this nice little sheltered old harbour. So it's like a long pier and you can see where boats used to go in the water. Anyway, no one's around but us two. So I'm like, well, I'm just going to go in skinny dipping. I'm going to go in naked. So that's what I did. I wasn't going to get my clothes wet. So I went for a wee swim, just didn't go out into the deep water. I just kind of stayed in the safe stuff. But getting in and out, the water was really hard because it was big stones and they were all covered in slimy seaweed. So you could really hard to walk on. So you're sliding all over the place, having to stay low. And as I'm kind of clambering out of the water, it took a very long time to get out of the water. I see just out in the distance a big boat coming by. And it was steaming up the coast, and it was a huge whale spotting boat. So it goes, I think it obviously goes round into the Pentland Firth and round the island. And obviously everyone's looking for whales and whatever else, dolphins, whatever they can see.
And they have binoculars.
They probably had the binoculars on. So there's me, my bum, just my white bum flashing them. And I just thought, you know what, who cares? They're so far away. So I just kept walking to shore and I probably gave him a wave or something. And it was funny, it's my girlfriend taking a picture of me struggling out the water. And you can see like a duck in the water and you can see a seagull in the sky. just as I was stumbling out. And I didn't really think much more about it because I thought, oh, it's a good day out. And so I've made a film also about the abandoned houses. I filmed some of the abandoned houses and they had like old mattresses in them or whatever. And I set it to some nice old music and I put it up on social media and a few people saw it. And it was really of interest to people from the area because they could see Stromae, they could see this island, but a lot of them had never been. And this woman, obviously from up around the area, they messaged me. She said, oh, I saw that video you did of Stromae and I thought it was really nice. She said, did you go for a swim that day? And I said, yeah. And she's like, I thought so. And she sent me a photo of me from the boat on a telephoto lens. She zoomed right in and you could see it was almost the exact same photo as my girlfriend took from the opposite side. So you could see the duck in the water and you could see the seagull in the sky. And then you could see me just stumbling out the water. So it's funny because you could see like from the two photos, two different sides. And it was like she would have never known it was me if I didn't have, you know, social media and posting on social media. So I thought that was like one of the like a cautionary tale for social media. Wee bit, you got to be careful where you skinny dip. So yeah, the tourists went looking for whales. But I mean, I think maybe they saw Free Willy, but that was it that day.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that is a great story. Yeah, social media—it's powerful, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. There's no escape from cameras and social media these days. You know, like the most unlikely place to be taking a photo of swimming. Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny.
That is very funny. Do you do all of your own editing?
Yeah. So I used to work as a journalist, right. Broadcast journalist. So you'd be going out making film. You'd have to go out radio and TV mainly. So you might have to go out and make a very quick turnaround video. So I learned a lot that way. So yeah, for my own personal stuff, yep, I do all my own editing. I quite enjoy the process. And I'm not a control freak, but I really enjoy having the independence and deciding what happens. So yeah, I quite like that.
Well, your story or your videos are hilarious. I very much enjoy them.
Thanks. Yeah, I think the latest one, I think, plays on people's deep water fear. So I think it's maybe people that haven't been into deep water so much, just imagining all the scary things that could be below you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I feel like that's, and it's even in pools when you're a little kid, right? Like I totally had that vision of like Jaws is going to come up and eat me from the deep end. Well, I can't wait to watch this video now.
I'm trying to hype it up too much. It's pretty straightforward. But I mean, as someone who's like, you're in the ocean so much and a diver, I think it's more for people that have that bit of thalassophobia, I think. I think it's more for them. It triggers a reaction maybe from them. So you might be immune to it, yeah.
All right. Well, I'm still going to take a peek. All right. At the end of each episode, I like to leave the audience with a conservation ask to go forth and bring into the world. What would you like my audience to take from your episode today?
Yeah, I think no matter, I think, what your goal is, so whether it's, you know, whether it's cleaning an ocean, whether it's planting seagrass, whether it's oysters, you know, no matter what it is, what I like to do is, or encourage other people to do as well, is show, don't tell. So that is where I'm making, you know, videos on social media, almost to set an example. The example I'll use in this moment is Scottish Gaelic. So I'll use it in lots of my videos because I want to see other people using it as well. And I want to encourage other people to use it. And as much as that, I mean, I would use it anyway very often, but almost using it as a deliberate thing. So whether you want to, you know, encourage people to take a step, show yourself doing it in the first place, maybe, whether you're doing that through photos, whether you're doing that through videos, you don't have to necessarily do it in that way. I mean, you could physically do it by, you know, going to your local beach and be there cleaning it and then to talk to someone who's passing by, walking their dog, and they might say, what are you doing? So show yourself doing something in the first place and don't just tell other people to do things. Mm-hmm. I think that would be for me a way of encouraging then other people and also influencing people to, you know, take the steps that you want to see happen in the world.
Right. Yeah, I like that. Lead by example.
Yeah, right. Lead by example. That's it.
Perfect. If listeners want to find you, connect with you, learn more about you or see your awesome videos, where's the best place to do so?
Best place to do so, if you're in the UK, you can see various programs I make on BBC Ullapa, the Scottish Gaelic channel, which is also available on BBC iPlayer. If you can find a way of, you know, not being geo-locked, you can also get that access to that in the BBC iPlayer, or you can follow me on social media. So I'm on a variety of different social medias, at Caldamac, C-A-L-D-A-M-A-C. Yeah, I might, since TikTok's been blowing up, I might go do more videos on TikTok now. But yeah, Instagram, I like to do lots of photos more on Instagram. A variety of social media.
Okay, perfect. I'll put a link to that and everything we chatted about today in the show notes. And also, one more time, what the title of your book, 1001 Tips for Outdoor Swimming?
1001 Outdoor Swimming Tips. Yeah, so it's not, okay. Some people might call it wild swimming. Can be a controversial topic, what you call it. But my book covers more than what you consider to be, you know, wild swimming. It covers into open water and, yeah, slightly more longer distance kind of stuff, maybe. And also, yeah, it covers all sorts of aspects of it that you might not consider in the first place. And it's even got my best cake recipe for having a wee cake after your swim. So there you go.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for chatting today and really enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be on.
Hey, do you want to help the oceans? Have you considered a career in marine biology, but maybe just aren't sure where to start? Head on over to my website, marinebio.life, and subscribe to my newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll receive a free PDF download where you'll learn the 7 steps to becoming a marine biologist without the degree.
Thank you for listening to today's show. I'd love to hear any insight you've gleaned. Leave a comment in the show notes or send me an email over at marinebio.life. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review and, of course, share with your friends. If you want more resources for ocean news, including conservation topics and careers, plus personal insight from me that I just don't share anywhere else, join me at marinebio.life and sign up for email updates. Keep after your dreams and making waves in your community. One person can make a difference. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you next time on the So You Want to Be a Marine Biologist podcast.